Welcome to the Disciple Matrix. We're glad you guys are here, and we hopefully, what we're going to do today will be helpful for you. At least it's been helpful for me to think about discipleship in my own context and think about the nature of discipleship, which is a word, a buzzword that is going around these days. And the question is, like, what does this look like, right? So the discipleship matrix is this idea about how do we talk about discipleship? What's a good way to talk about discipleship? So that's what we hope to talk about today. My co-teacher, I guess I'm his co-teacher, but this is Galen Van Rienen, who spent many, many years in Kenya as a missionary and then taught missions at Abilene Christian University and then was the founder of Mission Alive, where he was executive director for many years and still works with Mission Alive, which is a church planting organization in North America. And so he has been taught and been passionate about discipling people for a number of years, and I've learned immensely from him and some of the things we're going to do today. So,
well, and I introduced Ben Stevens. Ben has a way of floating among people and connecting and loving people. He's an addictive missionary. He's natural. By way of mission work, he was among the Basoga in Uganda for a number of years and now directs the missions at Oklahoma Christian University. What's your official designation?
Yeah, Director of the Center for Global Missions.
So. Center for the Director of Global Missions. And for me, he's a co-worker, a person that we walk together and is always an encouragement to me. Today, we're talking about discipleship. Sometimes discipleship is very intangible. We remember those words of Jesus, those last words. It's kind of the finale of the Gospel of Matthew. I mean, the resurrected Lord said, "All power is given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples, baptizing them, teaching them. I'm going to be with you always to the end of the age." All of us believe in discipleship. But the thing is, we tend to give information and somehow make that information be discipleship. And it doesn't kind of get into the nooks and crannies of our of how we live and how we act. And so in this session, we are going to do the discipleship matrix from a disciple background. And then what we will call the square tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about discipleship from the leader standpoint. And so we'll talk about L1, L2, L3, L4. But today we begin this description of disciples. We can talk. I'm going to do the tough part today. Ben's going to do the tough part tomorrow because he's going to interview me about my life in terms of this matrix. And then I'm going to talk to him, ask him about leadership. Discipleship is about how do we live as husbands and wives. It's about how do we live as ministers. And it's a fabric of life. Now, D1, we might call D1 someone is unconsciously incompetent. I'm a new Christian. But they don't yet know how to live as a Christian. There's an act, there's lack of understanding about the journey. And so we would call this stage the idealism stage. The idealism. In fact, let me write that here. The idealism stage. And later, we'll talk about the stories of this stage.
An example among in the Gospels of kind of what this looks like for a D1, kind of this framework for thinking about discipleship, kind of these four stages, which, by the way, I love this. I don't think this is the most definitive way the absolute way you have to talk about discipleship. And what it's done for me is helped me frame a little bit, give some parameters and structure to how I think about my own life as a disciple and how I think about when I'm ministering and discipling people, where I'm at and where they're at in terms of a disciple. Let me give an example of a D1, like a disciple one, say the idealism. In the Gospel of Mark, the first 8 chapters, something distinctive to Mark is that you have consistently the crowds follow Jesus. And you also have, consistently in the Gospel of Mark, demons that know exactly who Jesus is. They consistently say, "This Jesus is Son of God." The irony of the whole Mark 1 through 8 is that the demons know exactly who Jesus is, but they don't have the will to follow. They're constantly afraid. On the flip side, you have crowds following Jesus all the time. And the irony is, none of them know who he is. You consistently hear this rhetoric of they're amazed, they're bewildered, they don't understand, who is this, right? In other words, what he's describing, in a sense, is kind of this D1, this idealism. They're following Jesus. They're excited about what's happening. They're idealistic. But they have no idea what they got themselves into. Right? They are unconsciously incompetent. They're walking around. They're walking. They're following. But they're unconsciously incompetent. So the next move, when you go from D1 to D2, right? And this is a move that all of you will probably recognize at different points in your life. Okay? So you move from this idealism phase, unconsciously incompetent, to eventually you come around to a phase as a follower to where you become conscious of your incompetence. Right? And this is really the discouragement phase. You mind putting that up? This is the discouragement phase. This is the phase if you've had a new job. This often happens. Let's just apply this like a new job. You take the job. You're excited about the job. You're there like 6 months. You're there the year. And you realize, I don't know quite what I'm doing. And I'm pretty discouraged. In fact, the common sentiment in this phase of kind of being a disciple or being a learner is you really just want to quit. You really just want to give up. Because it's that awkward moment, kind of the idealism and the romanticism of something that's new, that you're not quite sure what you're getting into. You kind of hit those rough patches and you kind of realize what you've gotten yourself into and you go, whoa, I'm not sure if I'm going to keep with this.
I'm thinking about when Jesus was saying, "Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?" Apostles asked him. And Peter said, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God." I really say, "You're the Messiah." And we know the response of Jesus. "You are Peter, upon this rock I will build my church." I doubt if Peter understood that very deeply. I know for sure because in the next paragraph, Jesus begins to talk about how he's going to die. And Peter comes and upbraids him and says, no. The Messiah dying was not the Messiah that Peter had begun to follow. And that's why he was the wavering Peter, believing and following, but not yet the Peter that had come to maturity. He had not gone to the next stage. Now the next stage is what we'll call the adaptive, maybe it's the growth stage. it's a stage in which somebody says, you know, I will, how I can live as a Christian very easily. I know what I need to do. I know what holiness is. But a person has to be very conscious to be a disciple. So this is the stage of conscious competence. Because the disciple has to very much always say, I am following Jesus. I am following Jesus. Or the disciple can easily go back. As we'll talk about, you know, there's also the option to go back. I'm going to start a whole new way of life. So, or I'm going to start a whole new way of Christianity. So somebody goes back to be one on something else. And so this is this growth stage.
I think of, for example, in the Gospels, I think of Luke 10 for the adaptive growth. So Jesus sends out the disciples two by two. I think they have confidence. I think they still need direction from Jesus. He's the one still sending them out. But they have confidence. They can do it alone a little bit. But they are consciously competent about what they're doing. But they have to think about it. They have to be committed to it. They have to try hard. They have to still be led in a lot of different ways. I think of Luke 10 when they're sent out. So they're not fully on their own yet. But he's already sending them out ahead. Right, and then finally we come to D4, and this is the sweet spot. This is the place, of course, for everybody. This is the place where you might be most excited. This is the place where you're most discouraged. This is the place you feel like, but you really feel in a groove. Someone in D4, because they're the type of disciple, the type of learner that all of a sudden they've moved from consciously competent to unconsciously competent. They don't have to think about riding the bicycle anymore. They just get on and they can think about other things. Right? They have practiced the way of Christ. They have practiced this kingdom life. And they have been trained in this way so much that it's these habits have been formed. They don't have to think about it anymore. It's just second nature to them. Right? It's this kind of idea like the Greeks had about virtue, right? It's not our first nature, but we have to train ourselves in virtue to where it becomes our second nature, right? It's our second nature, but it's not something that happens naturally. It's something that only happens by beginning here and moving through some of these painful things all the way to being a disciple that's unconsciously competent, right? That can do it without thinking about it, right? So, yeah, Galen, give us an example.
Yes. Well, disciples get to the point that we hand the baton of leadership over to them. And so the passage I'm going to give is the Great Commission. I mean, Jesus, the resurrected Lord, is about ready to ascend into heaven, and he gives them the mission. Were they ready? No. But what Jesus does, it says, go and make disciples. One example is, I plant a church. I nurture that church, and they go through all of these stages. And pretty soon I say, this church is your church to lead, and the national leaders in Africa or in North America lead. Now, I guess we can talk about these stages with all kinds of examples, all kinds of areas. And so there's all kinds of ramifications. So I think our second part of the class has to do with those ramifications.
And really quick, I want to... I'm gonna ask Galen some questions. In fact, he's called this his confession time. Right? He's volunteered to be more confessional about his life as the disciple. which involves vulnerability, right?
No, this is wrong. I mean, he's forced me to do this. Now, I will turn around and do that to him tomorrow.
It is true. I have forced him to. But I want to say this about the one thing that's been helpful. With anything, models have their limitations, right? In fact, something that's probably not good, you know, like you, I'm sure most of you have done Myers-Briggs, right? Myers-Briggs, which is enormously helpful. Although I've been in groups that it's beyond helpful, right? You're talking to the Myers-Briggs and you say something, oh, that's the I in you. Like you get pigeonholed, right? So it becomes like this limiting thing. In other words, this for me is not a thing that has limited. It's helped me kind of get handles on what it means to think about my life and about ministry and about discipling other people, I think, in healthy ways, right? To think about at least some progressions through some things. The other thing that's very helpful to think about, and I think you'll see this in Galen's own confession time, I imagine, is that I'm not always, and we're not always in one place in all aspects of our life at any given time. It's not like all my life is in D2, right? I may talk about my family, and it may be here. I may talk about my work, and it may be here. I may talk about something else, and I may be in different spots. But just having some categories to help me recognize where I am, right? And then ways to think about moving through that. Developing the kind of habits, seeking the kind of mentorship and discipling with other people has been very, very helpful in my life. And also thinking about even my work in teaching students and discipling students. Right? I don't often go, oh, yeah, you're D2. Right? But in my mind, I recognize I've been there. I know where they're at. And I know the temptations about when you're here, about where you can go, but I also know at least some categories about how to move forward. So, confession time, you ready?
I guess so.
All right. I want you, describe for us where you are as a disciple in your family.
You know, as I begin to talk about the family, the arrangement of this room is really paradoxical because your wife is sitting in the back corner there.
Yep.
And my wife is sitting in the back corner there.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if they strategized to set that up. Okay, you did. Well, Becky and I are going to have our 46th anniversary.
Wow.
Coming up.
Good job.
It really is. It's a miracle.
Yeah.
But, I mean, somebody's put up with me. For you. I guess I'd like to say that she has nurtured me throughout the years. And I guess I've been very much of a leader. But she has always been behind the scenes nurturing me. In this paradigm, I would call our marriage at this point D4. We are a mature, our family is mature. Now, I think that we have gone through stages, yeah, maybe somewhat idealism, but we were not young when we got married. We've had some maturity. But I think that many times we were in D2. I think in particular, we raised our family in Africa. Our oldest son was 10 months old when we left. When we came back, our four children were 15, 12, 8, and 6. And God worked through us to plant a movement. I think that during that time, I wavered between D2 and D3 as a parent. And my confession, Ben, is that I was working with churches at different stages. And in fact, I'll talk about that over lunch tonight at our mission-wide dinner. I mean, some of them were this stage and that stage and the other stage, and pretty soon they were in the mature stage. And I was so involved in the work. You preachers, listen to this. I was so involved in the work that I did not give my children enough time. And, you know, I would come home, and we took that one day a week off. But sometimes also we did stuff for the family, just logistical stuff on that day. So I think that I wavered between that. Did I write anything down? I guess I said I had to learn to listen to Becky. And Becky then in many ways became my teacher. So at least these are some confessions. When we returned in 1986 from the mission field, I worked on my doctorate degree as I began to teach at ACU. And once again, my family didn't have a lot of my time. I began to give more of my time than later in my ACU years. And I praise God that Becky held us together. And so I guess I would say, yes, Becky, my relationship, even Becky co-taught with me in undergraduate classes at ACU. And so we've probably been D3, D4, but maybe as a parent, I've been more down here.
Let me ask a follow-up question. I'm interested, and you know I was going to answer. I'm just responding to what you said. What would have made a difference in terms of your family and your marriage between being D2 and D3? In other words, what do you know about discipleship now?
If I had to do my life over again, I would have set aside that day for the family in which we would do family things. And we, you know, when I came home in Africa, I would flash my lights because our house was down, and Becky would know if I had guests or not. We always did devotionals, but, you know, Kipsigis, the people we worked among, would come home with us, and sometimes they'd spread out and sleep in our floors because the next day they're going on a bus someplace else. And we'd do our devotionals in Kipsigis, or we'd do our devotionals in English, and usually we'd mix them up when we had guests. But I would more specially give that time to the family, to the children, and be more present.
Why don't you describe, you mentioned your mission work among the Kipsigis. Where would you describe yourself, and maybe take us through some of that when you were a missionary? Where were you as a disciple at different points in your ministry there in Kenya?
I had some advantages and a lot of disadvantages. I guess disadvantages, I have dyslexia, so here I go into another culture learning languages, and I had to have discipline to learn those languages. So I think that in some of my language learning, I stayed here at D2 for a long time. But God blessed me to not only learn Swahili, but also to learn Kipsigis language. I think that we made some mistakes because we were in Uganda one year, and then because of the chaos under Idi Amin, we moved to Kenya. And part of our team went over here and one here, two different tribes, because we thought since we were both in Swahili, we could have cohesion. But then when we realized we had to go into the local vernacular to really communicate the gospel, not in the trade language, we became a different team. Somebody else came into the team, and boy, Becky reminded me as we talked about this, how we as a team really were in D2 for a long time. So much so that Becky reminds me, and I had forgotten this, my feeling is I need to move to Eldoret, where eventually Monty Cox and Steve Meeks and some other missionaries moved that were close friends of ours. But you know, I think our team went through this now. I remember a time we were in a gathering of all the missionaries in Western Kenya, one of these wonderful Saturdays that we'd spend together. And I was sitting on the couch, and my co-worker, Richard Chowning, came up and sat down and said, "We're not doing very good as a team, are we?" I said, "No, we're not." And he said, "Well, I think we need to vote on decisions." Now, that vote on decisions, I mean, we always worked in terms of unanimous decisions. That broke the log jam. Not just a process, but also Richard, my relationship. And, you know, we began to work together as a team and began to do some writing and missions. But during that age, a few of you knew the Kipsigis Communique and Missionary Anthropology as a magazine. But we began to think and synergize, and we really became a team. You know, I go back to Kipsigis, and I still feel myself in D4 now. But I had to go through these stages, this discouragement and this adaptive. And, you know, when I sleep in Africa, I don't have... the Kipsigis, even today, you know, we left in 86, it just continues to flow. It's part of life. And, you know, that movement that went through this is today at 450 churches and is locally led and locally supported. So, all of this is hard because I think linguistically, I need to tell one story. Mm-hmm. I was just in language, culture and language school in Nairobi, Kenya, learning Swahili. And at that point, there's a European couple who had been in Africa 40, 50 years, and they kind of headed this Anglican school of language and culture. And we were having afternoon tea. I mean, this is an Anglican culture, and we were having afternoon tea, and this little old lady, Mrs. Ainsworth, sat down beside me, and she said, "You're not doing very good, are you?" I said, "No, I'm not doing very good. You know, I was in this stage. I can't learn this language." And she said to me, "You will learn this language. You're not very good at it, but you'll learn this language because you have purpose, you have discipline, and that's why." That was the encouragement. Wow, now tomorrow we'll talk about that in L2 leadership. A whole different way of leading according to where people are, leading incarnationally.
Yeah. Which is why this is it's been important for me to know these stages in order to lead. You know, one thing that Galen mentioned earlier was this idea, and I'm very much this way, that in Church of Christ particularly, we've been a people that if we get people the right information, they'll act right. Right?
Yes.
So you get the right teaching and people behave correctly. Well, you know, if you've had children, you can tell your children all day long, but that doesn't mean it's going to change how they behave. I mean, you still need to tell them. But information doesn't do it. Well, I'm the type that, hey, give me the information, and I want to go out and do it myself and innovate. And the rare thing in what I've discovered, luckily I had people that surrounded me before I went to Uganda. They were much wiser than me. I want to take it and then innovate it. Right? And part of what Galen was talking about is that rarely... I like to think I could take information and innovate it right away, but really the natural step is to get information and then to imitate it and then to innovate. Right? So a little bit of my experience is that this idealism of going into ministry, right, and going and changing the world. We always knew who the new missionaries were because they're the ones going to change the world.
Sure.
Right?
And it's great. It's what gets you to go. Like, right. Usually if you go in as a minister to a new place, you're very idealistic, right? That gives you the energy to start out. Then you move to this discouragement phase. But we had some very wise people, and I was actually learned this from Monty Cox that we went in. He said, okay, here should be your goal for the first year. And it kind of sounded stupid for us, but our church actually bought into it. Here's your goal. You have three goals your first year. And I want you to tell your church this. One is do language every day. Right? So do training of language every day. Two, go out to the village and just practice it. And three, be there at the end of 1 year. That was enough for us. That was full time. It was all we could do to be there after 1 year. Because we were in this place. Right? Culture shock, total disorientation, wanting to give up. So we kind of imitated, we actually were actually wise enough to listen to Monty and kind of imitate that. And it worked. Now, hearing all these stories about Africa, what I want you to hear, and I'm going to ask Galen another confessional question here in a minute that moves us into North America, what I want you to hear is not so much what happens in Africa, but when you hear us talking about language, right? We're all moving through these D1, D2, and although we're not learning any new language, we're always learning new language. My good friend Sean Smith moved to Naperville in Chicago. He's not from Chicago. He's having to learn the language of the lovable losers, the Chicago Cubs. He told me he's a Cubs fan. Even though they speak English. Is it the same language? Right? I'm sure you've been in D2 while you've been up there in other ministry positions. All right. And what's helpful is to hear, for me to hear these things that, you know, I'm okay. D2 is a really hard place, but I'm okay. And I know I need to imitate some other people, particularly in that stage. It's difficult to innovate. Well, let's move closer to home. Describe yourself, particularly in your role with Mission Alive, which is a church planting organization. You've spent a lot of time discipling people. Describe yourself as a disciple within your ministry at Mission Alive.
Well, of course, Mission Alive came out of my teaching at Abilene Christian. Let's go all the way to Mission Alive. Well, you know, Mission Alive was a calling because on a furlough, after teaching 14 years at ACU, out of my 18 years, after 14 years, wow, I loved ACU. We worked with students. My wife was a co-worker with me. We'd co-teach on some things. We were mobilizing teams, doing mentoring groups. And yet, on a sabbatical, we saw how churches were in free fall in North America. We were seeing how mission committees were doing projects instead of having a vision for evangelizing their communities in the world. I mean, even mission committees were consumer committees. And what does missions do for our church rather than that? And what we'll talk about in our dinner tonight at 4:30. That's a plug, by the way. We'll talk about how do we become an Antioch church that impacts our local communities and impacts the areas. In Africa, we fail forward. We had 50% reversion rate to animism over the first 6 years. And then the leadership formed. People began to speak prophetically. Likewise, in Mission Alive, we failed forward in so many ways. We believed in moving from theology to practice. But our church planters would pl- plant a church and it would grow to 80, 100 members and not like the church that they'd planted. And then they'd begin to speak prophetically because they're the kinds of people who speak prophetically, and the house would drop, the church would drop into a house church, which was not sustainable because that's a private territory and you need to be public and from house to house. Oh, wow, we failed forward. We talk about a triangle these days, that information is up top, Jesus taught. And so, the powerful Sermon on the Mount, and then Jesus said to his disciples, follow me. And so there's the second part of the triangle is participation. Follow me. And then the third part of the triangle is innovation. He sent them out on the limited commission, and then they came back. And so, I think we moved. We did a theology lab and a strategy lab. We separated theology and practice. We gave too much information. We didn't make it sticky. And so we would have churches that would grow up and then default into house churches and then not be sustainable, and they'd fade away. And pretty soon, in fact, I was in an equipping huddle with a ministry called 3DM, and my equipping leader asked about the training of Mission Alive and said, you guys are moving from information to innovation, and very few people can move from information to innovation. By the way, that's occurring in our churches. So, wow. At a crucial part in Mission Alive, here I am, a missionary that has taught for 18 years at ACU, was a missionary for 13 and a half, 14 years in Africa, and now we were 6-7 years into Mission Alive, and I knew that we had to redo our mission training. And now, what you're talking about here
is kind of an idealism stage. We know how to plant churches. I have experience in planting churches. And then I reached a point to say, this is a tough culture. I mean, in Africa, all the people live together in family and lineage, clan, and tribe. There was a distinct person of peace. And I could take Timothy's and Titus's and go visit that place, and pretty soon we'd go from one level to another level, and my Timothy's and Titus's would be working out there, and we'd plant another church. It's a little bit easier. And so, I guess even today, well, I would say in Africa, even today when I go back, I feel D4. Even today in Mission Alive, I think I'm in D3. Now, the joy of it is that my co-worker Todd Vogt, who does Catalyze Coach Training, works with Steve Schaefer, a whole bunch of other people in coach training. And then, I decided I was not the person to redo the whole curriculum of Mission Alive. That was a tough decision to make. I asked Charles Kaiser, half my age, to be the director of Mission Training. And that was not that Charles did that independently, but he knew this generation. He had the energy and the understanding and the stamina. And so we have just gone through a whole renewal. Our newer church plantings are coming up with a disciple-making process, coming through 2 years of training rather than labs that give information. And then the amazing thing, so I guess I'd say I'm still here, but let me say one more thing about Mission Alive. Pretty soon, we had churches beginning to come in and say, hey, how do we do this? And so we started church renewal. And, well,
churches have existing DNA that's hard to overcome. Churches have the possibility to become hub churches. This has been a harder journey in Mission Alive than in Africa. And I have stayed in D2 longer. And I still do not feel myself at D4 in North America. But I can be consciously competent, meaning I know what needs to be done, the kinds of imitative models, but it's not spontaneous. It just doesn't gush forward. And I think Mission Alive is coming that in that direction. I guess the theme is growing forward, failing forward, and growing forward.
I think we are about out of time. You want to announce tonight and then for tomorrow? Make a quick plug and then we'll be done?
Well, I think tomorrow we're going to be talking about leadership. We lead in different ways depending on who people are. So we're going to go through the discipleship matrix in terms of what we'll put here inside L1, how do we work in L2, L3, and L4. So that's what we'll cover tomorrow in this class. Tonight, we're going to be talking about how can we become an Antioch church. We feel that churches have within themselves the ability to multiply their small groups, their missional communities, develop them in ways that there are movements within churches. And the impulses then will lead us to also become church planting churches. So that's our dinner at the Han Fireside Room. Any last question or so? Any questions that come out of this?
Is it possible? To me, in some ways, it seems like a short step between D4 and D1 to be in this mature place, and then yet, you know, see something that now all of a sudden I was idealistic, and now I'm going through a process again. Is that?
Yeah, I think ideally, then you are still in D2. I think realistically, you might say, yeah, I'm D4 over here, but you're still discerning what it means to have competence in the Lord, a disciple that follows the Lord and processes. So I think that going around the square here or growing as a disciple is tough here. And I've drawn this line because in kind of this junction, somebody might say, well, they go to a whole new thing and then have problems with that. So there are some people that are always, they're always just kind of going like that. Does that make sense? But I think when one is at D4, there's certain habits that have been formed, there's certain things that are spontaneous. Now I think a person who's in D4 might actually say he's in D4 might actually be in D2 or D3 or something. There's always the difference between the real and the idea.
Question. When you mentioned innovation, I didn't quite understand, is that translating into the culture or the community? Mm-hmm. Is that what innovation is?
I went through this triangle very quickly. Mm-hmm. There's so much involved.
Oh, in okay.
But, I mean, very briefly, innovation is if you're going from information to innovation, mm-hmm. just a few people are able to do that. But if somebody is following someone else, mm-hmm. it's kind of like simultaneous innovations. You know, one person is playing off of another person, and so you're beginning to listen, and oh, there's truth in this and truth over there, and then you innovate out of the imitation. You're much stronger than if you are just taking information and then trying to apply it without ever seeing it in practice.
Can I give an illustration? Let me use a sports illustration. It's like someone that's never played golf or seen it.
Yeah.
And you explain to them, you tell them the information about how to swing a golf club, and then expect them to go out there and swing it correctly without ever have seen anybody swing a golf club. If you can imagine what that would be like, right? That would be kind of taking the information without ever imitating or seeing it happen. You just say, okay, well, I've got the golf club now. He told me how to do it. Let me try it. Right? It's gonna go horribly wrong, probably. Maybe that's an example.
Well, we'd like to thank you for your attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, discipleship has been nebulous. And I pray that, in a certain way, discipleship has kind of got some frameworks here that can help you along the journey. May God bless you.